For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're joined by one of the world's best-selling authors. Lee Child discusses his hugely successful Jack Reacher series and shares some surprising insights.
Male authors always make their characters 1 inch taller and considerably more muscular. And women writers make their characters have better hair and slimmer thighs.
Lucy Whitehouse introduces her new thriller, Critical Incidents, and a link to Lee Child.
Ask a question at the beginning of the book and answer it at the end and keep people literally dangling.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Lee Child is the creator of Jack Reacher, an ex-military cop turned drifter who roams the United States helping those who, the conventional forces of law and order, are either unwilling or unable to defend. The series is an international phenomenon. To date, there have been 23 Jack Reacher novels, several short stories, and 2 feature films starring Tom Cruise. But the creator of this all-American hero is British, and I heard that he only began writing to keep a roof over his head. So I wanted to make my own investigations, and was delighted when Lee Child joined me down the line from his home in New York. Lee Child, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, it's an honour to have you on the show. I just want to take you back to 1996, 1997, and how Jack Reacher came about. You, I believe, sat down to write purely for commercial reasons, really.
Yeah, purely to make a living. I was working for Granada Television in Manchester, and that job just came to an end. You know, it was like a lot of things in the 1990s, there was a lot of reorganization, getting rid of the old guys who had good deals and so on, and replacing them with cheaper people, same everywhere. And I was caught up in that along with millions of other people. And I was 40 almost when it happened, just turning 40, which was a kind of sinister time to be out of work. You know, you're a bit too old to start again at the bottom of something else. What do you do? And in my particular case, I just loved the transaction of entertainment, the idea that I could do something that other people were going to enjoy, that would make them happy, that they would look back on as saying, yeah, that was pretty good. I just always loved that proposition. And so it was further complicated for me. What am I going to do that keeps me in that world where I can produce something and somebody else is going to enjoy it? And I just got the idea to write a book. And for me, it would not have worked as a hobby or a thing that I kind of sort of wanted to do. It had to be real. And so the fact that I had to make my living doing it, I felt was tremendously helpful.
Are you a very disciplined writer then? Do you sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning with a first cup of coffee and start writing?
Well, not at 8 o'clock in the morning, because I have very few rules in life, but one of which is nothing of value is ever achieved in the morning. So I start in the afternoon. But yeah, I'm disciplined in the sense that all commercial writers are disciplined. I mean, it's difficult thing to explain to people because they want to hear that it is purely a joy, it's purely creativity, it's art, and so on, which is, of course, absolutely true. Yes, it is. It's all of those things. But simultaneously, it's also a job. And so you've got to do the work. So sure, I'm very diligent about it. I always start on the same day every year. I always have roughly the same schedule. And you have to take it seriously and do the work.
Well, it's clearly worked. 23 books and 100 million copies later, your Jack Reacher is a byword for the successful detective novel.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And out of every, you know, those thousands of people starting out in the middle 90s, I guess statistically you would expect almost all of them to fail and maybe one or two of them to succeed. And happily, by a coincidence, I'm one of the handful that succeeded, and I'm really, really happy about it.
And is it true that his name came about because your wife might have doubted that you would be a success when you're in a supermarket?
No, I think she was very brave about it, and I don't think she necessarily doubted that it would be a success. It was just like a joke comment. Every time I go in a supermarket, there's always a little old lady who asks me to reach something down from a high shelf because I'm a tall guy. And she said, you know, if the writing gig doesn't work out, you could be a reacher in a supermarket. And that's where the name came from, yeah.
And you are every bit as tall as Jack Reacher then, are you?
I'm actually an inch shorter. I read a lot of books. I know a lot of authors now. And it's fascinating to me how much autobiography is in a main character. But male authors always make their characters 1 inch taller and considerably more muscular. And women writers make their characters have better hair and slimmer thighs.
There's something I hadn't known.
Jack Reacher CV. Name, Jack Reacher. No middle name. Born 29th October. Height, 6 foot 5 inches. 1.95 meters. Weight, 220 to 250 pounds. 100 to 113 kilograms. Size, 50 inch, 127 centimeter chest, 3 XLT coat, 37 inch, 95 centimeter inside leg. Eyes blue. Distinguishing marks, scar on corner of left eye, scar on upper lip. Education, U.S. Army base schools in Europe and the Far East. West Point Military Academy. Service. U.S. Military Police, 13 years. First CO of the 110th Division. Demoted from major to captain after 6 years. Mustered out with rank of major after 7. Service awards. Top row. Silver Star. Defense Superior Service Medal. Legion of Merit. Middle row. Soldier's Medal. Bronze Star, Purple Heart. Bottom row, Junk Awards. Last known address, unknown. Family, mother, Josephine Moutier Reacher, deceased, French national. Father, career U.S. Marine, deceased, served in Korea and Vietnam. Brother, Joe, deceased, 5 years in U.S. Military Intelligence, Treasury Department. Special skills. Small arms expert. Outstanding on all man-portable weaponry and hand-to-hand combat. Languages, fluent English and French, passable Spanish. What he doesn't have, driver's license, credit cards, federal benefits, tax returns, dependents.
William Roberts narrating Gone Tomorrow. TB17396, written by my guest Lee Child. Obviously, the books have been phenomenally successful. I know some writers, when they get to that stage, employ a team to do their research for them. Do you have a team around you, or do you still do all the work yourself?
I don't have a team for doing research or the actual writing. I mean, obviously, I have an assistant and she has an assistant and I have agents and lawyers and so on. But in terms of the actual writing, it's a total one-man band. And it's an interesting question about research because I could have an assistant doing research, but there are two things wrong with that. First of all, I don't know yet what research I need doing. And secondly, I believe that brand new research, just recently done, doesn't fit very well in a novel because it's undigested. It hasn't percolated. The author doesn't know yet what is the important part and what is the boring part. And I think we've all read books where you can practically hear the author between the lines saying, hey, I've done the research, so I'm going to put it in whether I need to or not, damn it. So I think that is a significant danger with real-time research. So what I try and do is I rely on what I already know, what I've already seen or read about or experienced, and thought about could be years ago, could be decades ago, something that is fully formed in my mind. So I don't do fresh research every year. The really pretentious answer is, for a writer, your whole life is research. Everything you ever see or do, every movie you watch, every TV show, every book you read, every person you talk to, they're liable to come back to you in some context where you can say, yeah, that's what I need to do now.
I think one of the things that makes your books timeless, I went back and read Killing Floor again recently, is that Jack Reacher is not at all dependent on technology. In fact, he's very much off the grid. And there's nothing worse than reading, he punched the number into his cell phone and thinking, nobody does that anymore. Are you a bit of a technophobe, or did you take a conscious decision not to rely on technology as part of the plot as well?
Well, both, to be honest. I think that technology as part of a plot is always risky because, especially these days, you know that by the time the book is published next year, the technology is old and out of date, and it actually detracts, I think, from the story rather than adds to it. For instance, in the very first book, Killing Floor, there's a mention of an email. An email was sent, because back then email was a rare and exotic thing. But of course, the pace that things move on is phenomenal. The apartment I live in now was redone a few years ago, I guess, and it has all that wiring in it for the internet, Category 5 wiring, they call it. And of course, that's totally out of date just a couple of years later because everybody uses wireless now. So the thing to do with technology, I think, it's bad to plot it because it will appear out of date. And I also think the reader finds it somehow grounding or somehow reassuring if the story is taking place in a technological era that is slightly earlier than the one that they live in. I think it makes the reader feel more comfortable and less stressed in that sense. And personally, I have no particular interest in technology. I don't take any delight in it. I use what I have to, but I would be perfectly happy never to use it again.
Jack Reacher himself is a rather timeless character. I know a lot of people have compared him to a sort of Clint Eastwood figure in Westerns, but you tend to think of him more in terms of the medieval knight errant, don't you?
I do, because there is a long genealogy there that, Clint Eastwood in the Westerns or many of those Western characters, really. And going forward, you might say Philip Marlowe in the 30s, the same sort of character. That is a long genealogy that extends all the way back through the European Middle Ages, earlier than that, Scandinavian sagas, Anglo-Saxon poems, even back into Greek mythology. So, this is a truly timeless character who shows up periodically. I mean, there are some very famous legends, obviously, like Robin Hood and so on. Basically the same character, a maverick considering himself outside the law, taking care of problems for ordinary people who otherwise have no recourse. So, this is an ancient character. And of course, then you ask yourself, why? Why has this character been invented over and over again over the centuries? And the answer must be, people want that character. At a deep down level, people would love it. If you have a problem, somebody could just show up and solve it for you and then move on without demanding anything. That is a very deep human desire. People want that, which is why they keep reinventing the character and why they keep responding to the character.
I have a friend who's a policeman who said, it must be wonderful to be Jack Reacher. He doesn't have to fill out any forms if he shoots someone. I hasten to add, they're not a British policeman. But I think that, again, must appeal, that he can do the job and then just leave. He doesn't have to tidy up afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, the policeman who said that is exactly right and is sort of hinting at the fundamental appeal of this character, which I think is actually very complicated and very sophisticated, because everybody really, especially readers, people who enjoy narrative, people who listen to the books, listen to any book, if that's your hobby, if that's your way of entertaining yourself, then you are a more thoughtful person, you're a more educated person, you're a better person in general than people that don't. So you got this curious phenomenon where all these decent people, sensitive, intelligent, educated people, are rooting for Jack Reacher to shoot somebody in the head and walk away. And there's a sort of contradiction there. Why would decent people want that to happen? Well, they want it to happen because, and your policeman friend wants to shoot somebody without having to fill in the paperwork, because real life, although it's absolutely necessary, yes, of course we need due process, we need proper rights for both the victim and the accused, we need fair trials, we need evidence, we need all of those things, of course, in real life. But it is extremely frustrating. And so people love the fantasy escape of summary justice. If somebody is a really bad person, it gives us a secret pleasure to see him dispatched in that summary fashion.
Just don't get all scrupulous on me. This thing isn't going to be settled in any court of law with any dying declarations.
How is it going to be settled?
The first colonel I really fell out with, I shot him in the head. And so far, I like Lane a lot less than that guy. That guy was practically a saint compared to Lane.
I'll come with you to Patty Joseph's.
No, I'll meet you there, Reacher said. 2 hours from now. We should travel separately.
Why?
I'm going to try to get killed.
The Hard Way, written by Lee Child and narrated by Jeff Harding, which is DB23794.
Reacher is not a man to show regret. Equally, he's not at all gratuitous, is he? He does the job.
Exactly, yeah, and I think that's an important point, that he doesn't go too far. He takes no pleasure in it. He does what's necessary. But then he's extremely robust about it afterwards. He doesn't have regret or remorse. Just like in one of the books, I think it says, how do you feel when you put cockroach powder down? Do you feel guilty about that? Do you feel remorse? And that's how Reacher feels about bad people.
Now, one thing that might come as a surprise to some people is to know that Jack Reacher is as popular with female readers as with male readers. What do you put his success with women fans down to?
I think he's actually more popular with women fans. And again, I think that it's an interesting conversation. I once did a book event in Scottsdale, Arizona. And as it happened, there was a big audience. And as it happened, they were all women, all of them. And at the beginning, I said, look, I'm not going to do my usual book event because this is something that I need to know about. What is it that you find so attractive about Jack Reacher? And we had a long conversation amongst, you know, 120 people, lasted all afternoon. And a whole bunch of things came out. One is that still now, even in 2019, it is a little difficult for women to get assertive without being seen as shrill or angry. It is hard still for women to express anger and displeasure. And so vicariously, they love to see Reacher do it for them with terse one-liners and physical intervention. They love that. The second thing is that Reacher himself as a character has great relationships with women. He respects them. He likes them. He treats them absolutely as equals. He takes that as completely a given. And I think women respond to that too. The third thing they mentioned was the women characters in the books are all fully formed heroes of their own. They're just as smart as Reacher, some of them, just as tough as Reacher. And, you know, they're not usual thriller bimbos who go down to the cellar at the wrong moment and twist their ankle. These are capable people. And again, women readers respond to that. And then at the end of the afternoon, rather shyly, it came out that Reacher is the perfect affair because he breezes into town. You will have 24 hours or 48 hours of fun with him. And then he disappears. He will never be seen again. He will never write. He will never call. He will never show up on your doorstep. He will not complicate your life in the future. And I think secretly some women respond to that. You know, they would like to have a little fling, but in the real life, You can't. It's all messy. You get found out. You get divorced. It's horrible. And so the safety of the fictional narrative is something that they respond to there.
The woman had a gun in her hand. She was pointing it straight at me, low down, dead center, on the line between my groin and my navel. All kinds of necessary stuff in that region. Organs, spine, intestines, various arteries and veins. The gun was a Ruger Speed 6, a big old .357 Magnum revolver with a short 4-inch barrel, capable of blowing a hole in me big enough to see daylight through. But overall, I was a lot more cheerful than I had been a second before. Many reasons. Bombs kill people all at once. Guns kill one at a time. Bombs don't need aiming, and guns do. The Speed 6 weighs north of 2 pounds, fully loaded. A lot of mass for a slender wrist to control. And Magnum rounds produce searing muzzle flash and punishing recoil. If she had used the gun before, she would know that. She would have what shooters call Magnum flinch. A split second before pulling the trigger, her arm would clench, and her eyes would close, and her head would turn away. She had a decent chance of missing, even from 6 feet. Most handguns miss. Maybe not on the range, with ear defenders and eye protection and time and calm and nothing at stake. But in the real world, with panic and stress and the shakes and a thumping heart, handguns are all about luck, good or bad, mine and hers. If she missed, she wouldn't get a second shot.
And, of course, he's also notoriously clean living. He's not a drunkard. He doesn't have all the addictions that so many self-pitying detectives have. In fact, he's just addicted to coffee, really. Was that another conscious decision that you took in writing his character?
It absolutely was, and I'm glad you appreciate it, because there was a huge sort of tsunami, inflationary tsunami of misery amongst all these thriller characters. They were all drunkards or recovering alcoholics or divorced, traumatized, recovering alcoholics with teenage daughters who hated them. And I felt that, first of all, artistically, that was a bit of a shoddy choice. You don't make a character more interesting by making him miserable. And also, boring. I believe for the reader or the listener, what they really want is basically happy people if they can get them. And so I decided to make Reacher a real throwback to the sort of hero that doesn't have any problems. And theoretically, in the artistic sense, that should make him bland and not interesting. So what actually happens with Reacher is he does have peculiarities and eccentricities. But he doesn't know that he's got them. He's not aware of them. He doesn't care. He doesn't gaze at his navel. He's got no self-pity. He just lives. And I think people like that kind of cheerful, happy-go-lucky presentation rather than a tormented and tortured person.
And that's something that Tom Cruise really caught in the film versions, even if he was a little vertically challenged.
Yeah, wasn't that a shame? I mean, he really got the internals really, really well. And it was only the physical exterior that wasn't right.
I hear there's a TV series in the offing. Have you selected an actor to play Reacher?
We haven't yet. One step at a time, and we're moving forward on the TV pretty quickly, but it's a question of assembling the team first, and then we look for the actor. Could happen pretty soon. Yeah, Cruz was, you know, I enjoyed both of the movies. I enjoyed the experience of making them. I certainly enjoyed working with Tom Cruise. He was just a lovely guy, a real gentleman, an incredibly hard worker, really nice guy. But the readers never, ever accepted him because of that physical difference. You know, it has to be said that Reacher's physique is part of his characterization. It is who he is. He walks into a room, people are a little nervous. And that just wasn't happening with Cruz in the readers' minds. And so we came to a kind of mutual decision that, yeah, this had been good, but it wasn't hitting the spot. And I think now anyway, and I know this is a little outside of blind people's reckoning, but right now the place to do great narrative drama visually is on long-form television, streaming television, rather than feature films. So for many different reasons, it was the correct thing to do right now, and I'm looking forward to it, and I really hope that it works in a way that makes the readers happy this time.
Well, on the bright side, from our point of view, audio description has made such a difference to TV series. You don't always get it with a film, but actually the likes of Netflix and the BBC are pretty committed to making audio description a part of the production. So fingers crossed I'll be enjoying whoever the new Jack Reacher is in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, well, I'll make sure that they include that stuff because it is very important.
You must be delighted that all your books now, I think, have been made into audiobooks. Did you have anything to do with the selection of the narrator for those audiobooks?
Second time around in America I did, because at the very beginning, audio, when I started, it was a minority medium, definitely, and it was clumsy and it was clunky with tapes or CDs and all that kind of stuff. So it started out in a small way with a small company. And they gave me a reader called Dick Hill in America, who was great. He was the voice of Jack Reacher for a lot of people. Unfortunately, Dick just retired, and so we changed the narrator to a guy called Scott Brick in America, who was also really, really good. But along the way, I moved the audio rights from the original people to my book publisher. As audio became more and more important, they wanted it. But I did say, yeah, you got to continue with the same narrator, because I think people's personal relationship with the narrator is an important part of the experience.
One thing that I know some crime writers have an issue with, especially if you're writing a third-person narrative, is sometimes the narrator can give away the otherwise hidden killer by using that voice a little bit too early on when the killer is planning a crime. Do you ever now write with that in mind?
Well, you know, to be honest, I always have. Because quite apart from the utility convenience of audio, which is huge, you know, not just for people that are visually challenged, but for people with long commutes, people who like to listen while they're doing the dishes, audio is a huge thing. And I believe that is for a very deeply rooted reason, which is that human beings have been evolving for millions of years, and we got language along the way fairly recently in terms of that span, and we began to tell stories. So in terms of the human psyche, you know, what is deeply baked into our brains, maybe for 100,000 years, storytelling has been oral. You sit and listen to it. The bestseller guy of his day was the guy who had 20 people sitting in his cave listening rather than 10 people. Narrative has been audio for so long, and it's been written down on a page for so short. Regular people like me have been reading off a page for about 150 years, maybe a little longer, since mid or late 19th century, regular people learned to read. So reading off a printed page is a very new thing, and I think will probably be a temporary thing. I think the way technology is now, the way that people are so happy and familiar with downloading and digital files and things like that, I think we are going to see long-form narrative return to audio within, I don't know, 10 or 20 years.
And as far as the future for Jack Reacher is concerned, the latest book, Past Tense, has taken him to the New Hampshire town where his father was born and brought up. He's revisiting his past, but where does he go from here? How much longer can he carry on going?
Well, that is a great question. And it is, in a way, not up to me to say how much longer he can go on. It's really up to the reader. How long does the reader want him? And I'm sure they'll let me know when they've had enough, and I'll find out from the market in general. So I really don't know. In an existential way, I'm kind of concerned about that old showbiz maxim, get off the stage and leave them wanting more. Do not be the embarrassing guy that sticks around a few years too long and is remembered for the last few really terrible books rather than the earlier good books. So it's a strategic decision that I'll have to make at some time.
Well, I'm certainly hoping that he's got a few more cases in him. I'm hoping that you're going to bring him back to the UK and maybe a blind character or two somewhere in the future.
Yeah, that would be a great idea. I've actually known quite a few blind people, and what a fascinating life it is. You know, obviously very hard, but to be deprived of one of the senses and to make a success of your life is a hell of a thing. Years ago, I was contacted by a small organization. There's only like 200 members. They are ex-Marine Corps radio operators who have gone blind later in life. And they don't use audiobooks. They use Morse code. And so there's this service that we send a plain text file of the book, and somebody has a computer program that then turns that into Morse code. And around the country, 200 retired Marine Corps radio operators listen to the books on Morse code, which I think is extraordinary.
That really is an example of adaptability, isn't it?
It sure is. And, you know, there's no punctuation in Morse code, so it must be really hard.
You can't nod out for a moment. You'd miss an entire page of action.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
Well, I'll drink to that. Lee Child, thank you so much for discussing Jack Reacher with us and for all the entertainment that you have given to me and millions of other readers.
Well, thank you very much for that. And thanks to all the readers and thanks to the listeners who may be readers. Certainly they're readers of somebody, and that is great with me. I love a book. Listen to a book. You've got the whole world in your hand right there. You can live anywhere at any time. It's one of the greatest transformational things. And the fact that you can get that for a few quid is just amazing.
The guy at the wheel glanced at Reacher and said, "Which inspector is it?" The guy on the phone said, "The new one. Does he know he gets a turkey at Thanksgiving? I told him we're all on the same side here." The guy at the wheel glanced at Reacher again, as if seeking permission or offering an apology or both, and then he faced front again and said, "Did you offer him money?" 500. He wouldn't take it." Then the cell signal ran out. The sound went garbled, like a robot drowning in a swimming pool, and then it went dead. The screen said it was searching. The car rolled on. Reacher said, "Why would a person want a fireplace in an entrance lobby?" The guy at the wheel said, "It's welcoming." I think historically it was designed to repel. It was defensive, like the campfire burning in the mouth of the cave. It was intended to keep predators at bay.
Jeff Harding narrating Past Tense by Lee Child, which is out now wherever you buy your books. And you'll find a wide selection of other Jack Reacher novels available in the RNIB library. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And Lee Child will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
I think the whole talking book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
Joanna Trollope on the RNIB Talking Book Service.
I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the talking books do, and what the RNIB, I think, does in general, is save sanities before you know you get to the end of your life. The number of people whose lives have been transformed by talking books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasize how important that is.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Not only is Lee Child hugely successful, he's also well known for his generosity of spirit. One way he shows this is in his encouragement of other authors. Lucy Whitehouse is one of them. Her latest novel, Critical Incidents, is out now. And as RNIB reporter Hannah Towse discovered, Lucy has found Lee to be quite an inspiration.
I'm delighted to be joined by Lucy Whitehouse, author of Critical Incidents, a new thriller and quite the page-turner. Lucy, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Can you give us a bit of an introduction to your new book?
Yes, Critical Incidents is the first in what I hope will be a trilogy featuring Detective Inspector Robin Lyons, who is a Brummie natively, but fled Birmingham, hating the place at 19, moved to London, has built herself quite a good career in the Met and brought up her daughter Lenny, who's now 13, single-handedly. But at the beginning of this book, she's lost her job in the Met, her relationship's fallen apart, and she has to up sticks back to Birmingham with Lenny and live at her parents' house in bunk beds that she had when she was a child with her disgusting brother. And she's really taken quite a career fall because she has had this high-level police job in the Met, but when she goes back to Birmingham, she is working for a family friend who is a benefit fraud investigator, basically a private detective. But things take an upswing when Maggie, the private detective, reveals that she also has a sideline in helping women in jeopardy. And a missing girl is their target. They're recruited by her mother to help look for this girl. But before they can even start on that work, Robin's best friend, Corinna, who's been her friend since she was 11, who helped her out in the early days of Robin having her daughter, and is really the only good thing about being back in Birmingham, is found dead in her house, burned out, and her husband's missing. So, of course, Robin being Robin has to investigate.
Now, your protagonist, Robin, is having a pretty torrid time of things.
She is.
And it seems like she has this great relationship with her daughter, Lenny, for the most part, which is just as well. As you say, they're sharing a bunk bed. But she's quite combative with her mother, Christine,
and
with her brother, Luke. They bicker like vindictive teenagers.
They do.
Was it quite fun writing the complex dynamics between them?
It was really fun. That was one of the things I've really enjoyed about this book. Luke, the brother, he's the antithesis of Robin in many ways, and he is really resentful about that. And he thinks that Robin is their father's favourite, and he's probably right. But then Robin thinks that he's the mother's favourite. But one of the threads of this book, which will continue in the next two, is about getting perceptions of relationships wrong and learning how to read people better. I think it's fair to say that Robin is quite emotionally illiterate, and part of the fun of these books is her evolution, learning to be a little bit more emotionally intelligent.
As they rounded Terry Willett's white Ford Transit, the bane of her mother's existence, herself aside, for 25 years, she saw number 17 for the first time, and waiting in the ground floor bay, trapped like a bug between glass and net curtain, her dad. She watched him light up like he'd heard it was Christmas. In a whisk of nylon lace, he was gone. "Chrissy," she imagined him bellowing, "they're here." Seconds later, the outer porch door opened. Lenny ran to him, the bag thumping against her back. "Hello, sweetheart." He held her away to look at her. "You've grown again, haven't you? Who said you could do that?" He lowered his voice. "I've got some cream eggs in for you. We'll have one after lunch." "Lunch?" Lenny turned, eyes wide. Robin shook her head. "Say nothing."
Olivia O'Dowd reading Critical Incidents, written by my guest Lucy Whitehouse. Now, throughout the book, Robin discovers more and more about all the things that she didn't know about her best friend, Corinna.
Yes.
Friendships and secrets are something that are a bit of a running theme throughout your books. What is it that attracts you to those relationships?
I am fascinated by the idea of how well we can really know somebody else. My third book, Before We Met, was about what it would be like to be married to somebody who had a whole past or a whole secret that you really didn't know. The idea for that book was triggered by the fact that I got married to an American, and because of the back and forth and green card paperwork and everything, we really hadn't spent any time living together before we got married. And happily, that was 8 years ago, and it's fine, and I still think I made a good decision. But it was a leap of faith, and it could have gone horribly wrong. I'm not sure how emotionally intelligent I am. My sister is incredibly good at reading people, mm-hmm. and it's something that I've had to learn over time. And she just naturally understands people. I would say I'm much better at understanding other people than I am myself. And so I'm fascinated by body language and by listening to what people are telling you and understanding that there's something else going on behind. That's why I love writing dialogue for that same reason, that quite often what people don't say is just as important as what they do. That's really fun for me.
This is the first of, as you said, what's due to be a trilogy of books, but your previous four books have all been standalones.
They have.
How has it been trying to move from writing a standalone, where it's in one package, to putting enough in the first of a series to make sure that you can continue with the next two?
Well, that has definitely been a learning curve. I have to say, I've really enjoyed that part of it. If anything, I worry that I've got too much story rather than too little, because there's a lot of characters in this book, and they're all key to the story, of course, otherwise they would not be in there. But
and it is a great cast of characters.
Oh, well, thank you. They were good fun to spend time with, and I'm glad that most of them are still alive for book two, if not all. I have the overarching storyline for what's going to happen over the three books, and it is an exploration of those key relationships and also about, you know, a woman coming to understand herself a bit better and to straighten herself out. Mm. I think of Robin as someone who's basically been too busy for the past 13 years to emotionally develop.
Although you're from Warwickshire originally, I believe.
I am, yeah.
You now live in Brooklyn.
I do.
But all of your books are set in the UK, apart from you've got a bit in Before We Met that sort of references New York.
Yeah.
Why have you decided to stick with the UK rather than put it in a different setting?
My imagination just seems to get triggered by British things, I think. Although I got married in 2011, I've been going back and forth since 2009. But I feel deeply British. I love living in America. I love New York. I've got many American friends, but I will always be British. And when I arrive at Heathrow, I will always feel that I'm home. And that's very interesting as a writer, actually, to kind of be an outsider, slight outsider in two cultures, not really inside either, because, I mean, just now I forgot that you have to touch out on the tube here, which you don't have to do in America. It's so small things by just becoming practically incompetent in London, and you forget. But in particular, this book, the seed for it was my father dying in 2014. He was Birmingham born and bred, and his family has had for many years a small engineering business that's passed from father to son. And so when he died, my cousins took over. So the business goes on, but my father's gone. But he was the real source of all the information about our family and the Birmingham past, because my other uncles are not as into history. I expect one of them is, but I need to speak to him. I haven't had a chance to as much as the other one, but my dad was the one who talked to us about the White House side of the family and the business and how kind of intricately it was tied into Birmingham history. And he was a very proud Brummy. And when he died, I felt as if I was losing that connection. And then somebody asked me if I'd ever had an idea for a recurring female character. And I said, yes, I really want to write about a detective who moves from London back to Birmingham, where she's originally from. And I had no idea I was going to say it. It just came out of my mouth. And I thought, oh, subconscious, you're really not subtle. Particularly now being in Brooklyn as well. Mm. Just that sense of where do I come from and losing touch with that, which certainly happened to me quite strongly when my father died. It made me want to strengthen those ties. And so I've gone back and learned about his city and visited it and fallen in love with it, actually. I'm a big fan of it.
It's wonderful. And it's actually beautifully referenced with Corinna's husband's, Josh's, factory and their family, and also with one of the other characters, Kev, this idea of a family business and all the rest of
that
it.
That was something that I hadn't realised, actually, that the family business is quite a Birmingham thing. And before massive industrial decline, there were lots of small family business, kind of cottage industry, metalworking. So my father's business, which makes Tube, was quintessentially Birmingham. It's quintessentially British too, it really is. But yes, it was little, small-scale metalwork, family business, been going since Victorian times. And that was just, it was fascinating to me. And also lovely. I love Kev in the book.
He's a great character.
He's funny and just nice. He has a bigger part in book two.
It's nice that you reference also things like Bourneville. So you get a sense of the industry of Birmingham. Mm. Now, you've had Lee Child endorse your book.
I have.
Which is pretty fantastic.
He is wonderful.
How influential has his advice and his writing been? Because I know that you worked for his literary agent at one point.
I did, yes. Before I was a full-time writer, I worked for Lee's agent, selling translation rights in Spanish and German. And it was a pleasure to work with him. He is an incredibly generous man in terms of his advice and support of other authors, and he's deeply loved in the community for that. Yes, he's wonderful. I hadn't spoken to him for years. He is also a Brummie. Mm-hmm. And I sent him a little note saying, Lee, can I send you a copy of my book? And I thought he'll be far too busy, but he read it and gave me a quote. He's been huge in practical terms too. One of the things I love about Lee is he makes these kind of very simple statements which then turn out to have lots of depth. Like creating suspense, ask a question at the beginning of the book and answer it at the end and keep people literally dangling. It sounds simple, but it's the underlying principle.
In one sentence.
Yeah, exactly. That's him.
So you've got the audiobook coming out at the same time.
Yes.
Were you involved or did you go hands off with that part of it?
I was quite hands off, although I was sent a sample of the actress who's reading it. I thought her voice was perfect, and I think she's just going to be just right for Robin. I think she'll tell it really well. And she is a native Brummie, and she also went to UCL, which is where Robin went to university.
Lastly, have you had any experience of sight loss yourself within your family?
Yes, I, on a minor level, have quite poor eyesight. I'm quite short-sighted, and I've also had vitreous detachments in both eyes, so I have trouble with floaters. As my friend Peter said, never paint a white wall, Lucy, you'll go crazy. But my grandmother had retinitis pigmentosa and was registered blind in her early 20s. Sight loss is something that we're very conscious of in our family. Luckily, she hasn't passed it on. One of my great fears, actually, is not being able to read. So to know that there are audiobooks, and really good quality audiobooks available to listen to, is massive. I used to work for Isis Publishing. That was one of my early publishing jobs. And so I used to buy the audio rights for a long time, and we used to share recordings with the RNIB. And my grandmother used to borrow books too.
Well, Lucy Whitehouse, thank you so much for joining us on Read On. It's been
an absolute
pleasure to talk to you.
And likewise.
I have to tell you, I can't wait for the next book. We hope you will come and join us when the next one comes out.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Hannah Tause and to Lucy Whitehouse. Critical Incidents is out now in hardback and audio and available as TB704253. From the RNIB Library.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
And now it's back to Lee Child for the books of his life. Lee, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, yeah, all of them. I mean, literally all of them. I'm an old guy now, and it sort of takes me by surprise to look back at how different things were when I was a kid, and there was nothing to do except read. And so I lived in books, absolutely. They were all important to me. Enid Blyton, Just William, all those kids' books, and then Alastair MacLean, as I got a little older. I would say he was my real first inspiration in that sense. I mean, I was only 9 or 10, so it was a long time in the future, but I can still link back a lot of what I do to the absolute pleasure I got from reading Alistair MacLean.
And is there a book in particular that sticks out of his?
Well, he's actually a good example of how not to manage a career, because his early books were great. Then he went to Switzerland as a tax exile and became a drunk, and his later books are terrible. So it's got to be one of the ones out of the early section. And my favorite would be The Last Frontier, which was set in Budapest and was about the, you know, Eastern European communism. It's a surprisingly enlightened book in terms of its argument. And of course, the action is terrific.
The wind blew steadily out of the north, and the night air was bitterly chill. Nothing moved across the snow. Under the high, cold stars, the frozen plain, empty, desolate, stretched endlessly away on every side until it vanished into the blurred distance of an empty horizon. Over everything lay the silence of death. But the emptiness, Reynolds knew, was illusion. So was the desolation and the silence. Only the snow was real. The snow and that bone-deep, sub-zero cold that shrouded him from head to toe in a blanket of ice and continuously shook his entire body in violent, uncontrollable spasms of shivering, like a man suffering from ague. Perhaps that feeling of drowsiness that was beginning to creep over him was only an illusion also. But he was aware of that it, too, was no illusion. It was real, and he knew only too well the meaning it carried with it.
The Last Frontier by Alistair MacLean is available in Braille and as TB10130. It's narrated by George Hagen. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, lots and lots of them. Of course, I don't live in England anymore, so rainy days are few and far between. But I'm looking forward to maybe in the future, if I do retire, having time just to do exactly that. And I know which the first it'll be, and it'll be probably the sixth or seventh time I've reread it. Sophie's Choice by William Styron, which I think is, you know, if a Martian came down from Mars and said, what is a 20th century novel? You would want to give him Sophie's Choice, because it's just a fabulous, fabulous product of what had happened in the 20th century.
At 22, struggling to become some kind of writer, I found that the creative heat, which at 18 had nearly consumed me with its gorgeous, relentless flame, had flickered out to a dim pilot light, registering little more than a token glow in my breast, or wherever my hungriest aspirations once resided. It was not that I no longer wanted to write. I still yearned, passionately, to produce the novel which had been for so long captive in my brain. It was only that, having written down the first few line paragraphs, I could not produce any others. Or, to approximate Gertrude Stein's remark about a lesser writer of the lost generation, I had the syrup, but it wouldn't pour.
Sophie's Choice by William Styron is available as TB16173, which is narrated by William Roberts. Finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
A few years ago, I read a book called The Lost by Daniel Mendelsohn. And turns out Daniel Mendelsohn is a classics professor at the University of America. Really great writer, really smart guy. But the book that he wrote, it was actually the beginning of a new genre that's emerged. They're calling it third generation memoirs. What it typically is somebody investigating their grandparents' life or their grandparents' generation's life. And in this case, Daniel Mendelsohn, he was a Jewish kid in New York, and he would go down to Florida as a kid to visit his elderly relatives. And at 7 or 8 years old, he would walk into a room, and they would all burst into tears because he so resembled the only member of their family that did not get out of Europe in time prior to World War II and died in the Holocaust. And so after that introduction, Mendelssohn became obsessed with this. It was actually a great uncle. A great uncle, his wife, and four daughters. Six of the family went missing. And he makes it his task to find out what happened to them. And it is partly a rumination on storytelling. It's partly a rumination on the Old Testament. It is absolutely a suspense novel, a detective novel. And it is, unfortunately, a horrific memoir of something that happened in the 1940s.
As it happens, this is precisely how the Greeks told their stories. Homer, for instance, will often interrupt the forward motion of the Iliad, his great poem of war, spiraling backward in time and sometimes space in order to give psychological richness and emotional texture to the proceedings, or to suggest, as he sometimes does, that not knowing certain stories, being ignorant of the intricate histories that, unbeknownst to us, frame the present, can be a grave mistake. The most famous example of this, perhaps, is an encounter that takes place toward the beginning of the poem between two warriors named Glaucus and Diomedes. As the Greek and Trojan prepare to fight, each launches into a long story intended to highlight his military prowess and his family prestige, and the genealogies they retail are, as it happens, so long and detailed that it soon emerges that there are important family ties between them, and with cries of joy the two men, who only minutes before would gladly have killed each other, clasp hands and declare eternal friendship.
The Lost by Daniel Mendelssohn is out now commercially in paperback, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Bronson Pinchot.
It only remains for me to say, Leachard, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
My pleasure.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.